the administrative rules and other memoranda governing that position at the state level, and anything else that they might need for information to educate themselves prior to them coming back together as a subcommittee. Be able to do that.
Mr. Chair, we will, of course, do that. Just two very quick comments. Again, we appreciate this opportunity because what we have had to deal with thus far are individuals who have made explicit, almost on top of the rock kind of allegations against the operation of the employment division. But the interesting thing about it, that none of those individuals have bothered to come inside of the employment division to find out exactly what is going on. So your subcommittee gives us an excellent opportunity. The second point I would like to make is we would make to this committee the same offer we made to Senator Hill. The allegation was made that the MFSW has been transferred because of some advocacy. We told Senator Hill at the time that our decision rise and fall on the records we have. We sent a list of those records asking the senator to choose from any one or all he wanted. We would gladly make those records available to him. We would do the same thing for this committee, so the committee would at least have both sides of the coin and then make a decision. We appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. So I will appoint that subcommittee.
And, Mr. Chair, before we conclude, I would like to specifically request a transcript of this part of the hearing.
Yes, I think that would be a verbatim transcript in order to illuminate the issues. Okay, that subcommittee is appointed. The chair has one other item. If there is no objection from the committee, the chair would order counsel to draw three subpoenas for the purposes of calling the three previous occupants of the minority advocate position before that subcommittee. I'm doing that not by virtue of the fact that I think they would not appear, but by virtue of the fact that they really ought to be brought forward at the request of the committee so that their continued state service might not be affected. We're not asking them to come up and volunteer. We're ordering them to appear. Is there objection to that order to counsel? Hearing none, we'll order those subpoenas. We'll close the matter on that.
Mr.
And
Chairman, before you get off there, you need to appoint a leader, chairman, or something of that sort.
Senator Hill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have one other item of business which we'll take up when Senator Grensky returns. And I will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 553 and call Senator Hill. Do you wish to join the first panel down there? Or do you wish to speak from your chair?
I'll speak from here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, while you're doing that, I'm going to call Cipriano, is it Farrell? Is that correct? And Larry Kleinman, why don't you guys come forward? Senator Hill, why don't you
Mr. Chairman,
present some opening remarks?
While the witnesses are coming. Senate Bill 553.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Repeating committee meetings. Senate Bill 553 is a bill that extends state labor relation protection to agricultural workers. Currently, agricultural workers are not included under the Federal Labor Relations Act and also are not included under the state equivalent, the state statutes, which are governed by the Employment Relations Board. The federal act is governed by the NLRB. As a result of this omission, there is literally no guidebook to settling grievances or labor disputes in agriculture. There's no statutes that apply. It's a wide open field. There's nothing to prevent damaging activity. There's nothing to prevent strikes. Strikes may occur even without being subject to the labor standards in state law. Grievances occur, and there are disputes in the fields right now. But the problem that we're addressing in Senate Bill 553 is there's nothing to govern the relationship between the employer and the employee in agriculture. What Senate Bill 553 does not do is legalize strikes. Strikes by agricultural workers are currently legal. Other labor activity is currently legal. So we need to get that clear right off the bat. This is a bill that provides guidelines to how these disputes proceed. And it provides the same guidelines that other employees governed by state or labor relations law are governed by, with some adjustments because of the nature of the industry. So I'd like to turn it over to you guys. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
We'll need your name. For the people who haven't testified before, whenever you start testifying, give your name, your organization, if you represent an organization, then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Cipriano Ferrer, and I'm the current president of the Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United. We're a farm workers union with over 2,100 members. Our primary goal is to sign collective bargaining agreements with the employers of our members, which work in the nursery, reforestation, and farm labor industries. The right now, farm workers can get fired without cause or without notice. We have some conditions out in the farms that we'd like to see changed. We find that our members, farm worker community, is not making enough money to buy the basic necessities. And what we try to organize ourselves to correct these injustices, we often find ourselves threatened, fired, blacklisted, or even beaten. This is what farm labor is in the state of Oregon in 1989. Now the efforts of farm workers to create to build a place for themselves in the national life is not anything new, but it's one of that has a long and valiant history. Since the turn of the century, we've seen that farm workers have made efforts to organize and create their own organizations to represent them in terms of negotiations with their employers. And we have the history of farm labor organizing is one that is not very well known, but that has been kept in the dark, maybe because of the rule setting, or because the situation just isn't given enough importance. But like I said, the turn of the century was really when farm labor organizing started. In 1915 in Wheatland, California, a hop grower there advertised for 2,800 workers, where he actually just needed 1,500 to take care of his job. And when all the workers came up, they didn't find any jobs. A lot of them were left without work, and a lot of them, or the ones that were lucky enough to find work, were paid very, very low wages. They were charged for the tents that were set up for them to live in. They were sold the food and drinks there at the labor camp. And when these people met to discuss their grievances and how they were going to present them to the grower, the sheriff's department came in and opened up fire and killing two of the workers. This set set a pattern for the kind of retaliation that was in store for them for organizing themselves and asking for better treatment. In 1933, the same thing happened in Pixley, California, where this time it was cotton pickers. Again, they were organizing to get better wages. They felt that they were getting they weren't making it. And during a mass meeting of that group at the Union Hall there, again the growers came and surrounded the Union Hall, opened fire, and again two farm workers were left dead. And our history is full of these incidents. In 1933 alone, in that same year of the Pixley massacre that it became known as, there was 25 strikes in the state of California alone. Stock and Arvin, all of these places had farm labor disputes all through the history. In the 1960s, the United Farm Workers started an organizing committee there in the Central Valley, which brought the attention not only to the rest of the nation but throughout the world of farm labor organizing. And this union had the biggest impact this country has seen in farm labor organizing, and they made tremendous strides in terms of improvement of living and working conditions for farm workers. But that struggle was not an easy one, and it goes on today. Since they started organizing, they've been opposed by the growers, and they too have suffered the loss of their members in retaliation. But they continue fighting on. The United Farm Workers has been an inspiration for farm worker groups all over the country, including ourselves. In terms of Oregon, we also see the history of the state of Oregon spotted with all these labor disputes, farm labor strikes from the 40s when the first braceros were brought into the state. We started seeing strikes there. We've seen strikes in all the industries. But what happens is that when we strike, we have no protections, and all the growers or the owners have to do is either wait us out or bring in more workers, and we're out of a job. And yes. There's no
Cipriano, let me ask a question. Basically, there's no requirement for either side to engage in good faith negotiations.
That's correct.
During a strike. And that's what you mean. There's no negotiations required to continue on a good faith basis.
That's correct. If we have grievances or we want to ask for more wages, there's nothing that says that a grower or farmer has to recognize us as a representative of those workers. Last year we had a strike in the Strawberries, we had a strike in Medford, and all of these dissolved because of the fact that there's nothing that in the law that says that they have to recognize us. Our union has met and negotiated several times with the local growers.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Houghton.
Yeah, let me, before we get beyond that point, under the collective bargaining agreements now in the private sector, even though you strike, there's still no assurance that, that you have to negotiate beyond that point. And your point is what, under the present system where you don't have any kind of labor relations,
mm-hmm.
It's only prior to the strike that there is some kind of requirements to negotiate.
That's correct, but we don't even have those protections prior to a strike. We don't even have.
Well, I thought I heard your testimony the other way, that you had no protections after your strike.
No.
Well, no one.
No. That's correct.
Other than
even before a strike situation, there's no protections there for us. We've negotiated with several of the local growers here, and we've gotten to the point where we've almost been ready to sign the contract, and because of the pressure from their peers, their fellow growers, they've backed down, and we can't do anything. They've told our members to stop paying dues to our union, or else they would lose their jobs. They've jacked up their wages.
Let me interject. It's even with the protections of the state labor laws, you may not get a contract, and I think that's something you need to recognize. But you don't currently have protection from unfair labor practices. In other words, there's nothing that says the employer can't threaten or force a worker to not pay dues. if you were covered by the state labor laws, you'd be protected from those unfair labor practices. And I think that's an important point that needs to be made, too. So you may not get a contract, you may not be successful, but you'd be protected from what is normally considered to be unfair practices by the employer. And in turn, the employer, there's turnabout's fair play, the employer is protected from what is normally seen as unfair labor practices by the workers. So that's what you're seeking.
Right. This the overview of the history of farm labor points that out. In over 50 years ago, when the National Labor Relations Act was adopted, farm workers were left out. And all the history shows us is that what we needed to do was also to include farm workers in the 30s when the rest of the workers were given these protections, these rights.
Let me ask you. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you. Why was it that farm workers were left out? Do you have any understanding of that? Can you help us understand that?
Yes, there was we have opposition to 553. There was opposition back then, and at that time it was felt that and some of the feeling was that they would go with the exclusion of the farm workers, hoping that they would bite off a small piece, and then later on they would come back and include farm labor. Well, we've been waiting for 50 years and we're still not included, and that's why we're here today to ask that that you give us the opportunity to voice our opinion, whether or not we want to be represented by unions or not. And if the farm worker decides not to be represented, then that's at least we've had a fair shake, and farm workers ultimately will get their say in something that affects their daily lives.
Questions? Senator Shoemaker?
I just want to be sure I understand correctly. The purpose of Senate Bill 553 is to bring farm workers into the same state of labor relations as other employees enjoy, with special provisions that apply peculiarly to farm workers.
That's correct.
As things stand now, they're outside the tent. This will bring them in the tent, and that's what all this is about.
Okay. Senator Hout?
Well, one of the reasons that farm labor has been excluded is because of the seasonality of it and the effect of a large number of people working a short amount of time dictating the policy to all other workers on that particular unit of work. In other words, if you had two or three people that worked year-round on a farm that did not wish collective bargaining or did not wish to be represented, and you had a short amount of time span with a large amount of people, strawberry pickers coming in picking for 1 week, holding the election during that 1 week period and dictating the labor policy for the rest of the year, is one of the reasons that industry has been set off to one side, because you don't have a reoccurring workforce on most small units. Large units, you know, that argument diminishes. But that's one of the reasons why the agriculture industry was zeroed out, because of that phenomena that is more unique to it than other forms of employment.
Mr. Farrell, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think that's true, that is what happens in this industry. But that decision was a decision of that magnitude based on that is, I don't think, is very fair, because even the what we call a steady worker has more to gain from a collective bargaining agreement than a seasonal worker. So we're saying that let them make the decision, or let them be part of that decision.
Okay, Larry Kleinman.
Thank you, Senator Hill. I'm Larry Kleinman. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United. And I'd like to make a couple of points in reference to the testimony of Mr. Ferrell, and then also, if with the committee's permission, walk the committee through what a farm labor election would look like if this bill were to become law, just to get a better picture of how the process would function. But I think in reference to what Senator Shoemaker was asking a minute ago, I think that our overall objective with this bill is to, once and for all, create an orderly, democratic, peaceful, and impartial process, and not wait for the day that we have additional labor strife, additional strikes to gain union recognition that could otherwise be head off. And there's no reason why we should have to follow in the footsteps of the state of California, where there was a considerable amount of strife before their bill was passed, and have to face that here in order just to get these types of basic protections. We also see this bill as leveling the playing field, as a term I know that Senator Hill has used in referring to this legislation. That is to say, it's not designed to give farm workers an unfair advantage. It's designed to put farm workers in the position of having their will by majority respected. And if they want a collective bargaining representative, they should have one. It does not, as you say, obligate particular contracts. It does not obligate what's to be in those contracts. That's a matter for collective bargaining, if done in good faith. Now, there's been, I'm sure in other testimony you'll hear, either today or on another occasion, references made to the California law. It is our intention to make available to the committee an individual who is an expert in that, who's worked in that under the Agricultural Labor Relations Act and the board that administers it in California and has done so for many years, so that the committee can get a firsthand idea of how that has functioned, where it has functioned, as it has in California. Many problems have been attributed to it. We would characterize those, I think, generally as being the result of inadequate or improper administration, not the fault of the law itself. So we want to create a process whereby a lot of these problems can be solved without resorting to unnecessary sacrifices on all parties' parts. I'd like to also to mention that I believe in the packets that were prepared for the committee, there is an overview of the bill, its essential provisions. There's also an overview of existing state labor procedures. And I think that's important because we're not creating with this bill, a whole new apparatus and a whole new law and a whole new structure. We're saying the best way to do it is to incorporate us into the existing structure that's provided by state law, repeal the exclusion of farm workers, and allow for the particular procedures that obtain in farm labor. Also, we have drafted for the committee's later consideration, but provided them all, or asked that they be provided to the committee at this time, in case there are any informational questions, certain amendments, technical and otherwise, yes, that we think better, yeah, that have been
hand engrossed
into the version of the bill for discussion purposes. That having been said, let me walk through what we imagine an election or election process would look like. Let's assume that on a given farm, a substantial number of the workers employed there want to have union representation. The process would be, first of all, that there would have to be a substantial showing of interest, and that's true under existing law, that we would be included within. That, I think, by current regulation is 30% of the workforce currently on the job. Now, one provision that we've incorporated from California law requires that elections only be held when there are at least 50% or more of the peak labor force on the job. And it is a balancing test, as I think Senator Hawk alluded to. That's true that there are some steady workers. They may have slightly different interests from workers that are there more seasonally. But we feel that the balancing test is best tips in favor of having at least a substantial portion of those workers there to decide the issue, because it is an issue of ongoing representation for everybody if it's voted in by the majority. In other words, if you have 100 people working seasonally and 10 people working steadily, those 10 people shouldn't be relied upon solely as the decision, in a 6-4 vote, but among them, when many times that number of workers are affected. So there are only certain limited windows, you could say, of time each year that elections can occur. And those might be in, let's say, in a planting season, perhaps in a harvest season, typically is when I think there's the most labor, and there may be other exceptions. So in other words, the first question that would have to be asked about workers wanting union representation and wanting a representation election would be, are there 50% or more of the peak employment for the year? Are there that number of workers on the job? And if there are not, then the issue is not ripe to be petitioned. You'd have to wait until there are that many and then present your petition. Otherwise, it would be simply untimely.
Mr. Kleinman?
Yes.
Chairman?
Senator Kleinman.
Is there, in fact, sometimes a difference of wishes between permanent employees and seasonal employees regarding their wish to be represented by a union?
Well, I would say that in our experience, that is not a reliable indicator one way or the other. May be a difference of opinion seasonal workers on that subject.
I guess what I'm getting at is wondering if there would be any sense or whether we should be thinking about it as we work our way through this, drawing a distinction between the two, so that if the seasonal workers should elect to unionize, that the permanent workers need not. They could be a different bargaining unit, if you will. Is that something that we should think about as a possibility as we discuss this?
Well, if I can respond, in a lot of these farms in Oregon, they're real small operations. So a lot of times, once the work cools off, the steady worker who in the busy season is doing the tractor and doing a lot of the technical stuff, he goes back out and does, to keep himself busy, does a lot of the sure. farm labor, the general labor. So it's really hard to differentiate them, to pull them apart, right? Because they're all pretty much doing the same thing. It's just that one works more hours than another. So, and they always have the option of voting.
Well,
and
seems to me the difference is that the permanent employee is there year round and perhaps years round, and the seasonal employee may be there one season. He may be there again the next season, but he may well not be. It seems to me there's a real difference in their kind of loyalty they might have to that particular farm and their attitude toward it, their attitude toward each other, that would distinguish the two classes.
I would say that, again, I don't think our experience bears that out, that in the sense that there are certainly some individuals, more often than not, those individuals are in supervisory capacities, and they would be exempt from the bargaining unit anyway by the existing definition of employee. But it may very well be true that the issues around which collective bargaining would be sought or be urged or be felt by those workers for steady workers might be different issues, a different set of issues than for the seasonal workers. For example, steady workers may be looking more for the issue of benefits than the issue of wages, and a short-term worker may look more to the issue of wages than benefits. But that really, in our opinion, in our experience, that is a real possible difference. But that's not a difference that gets to the fundamental issue of union representation. That more gets to the issue of allowances in the contract or in a contract negotiation by saying and setting up a formula whereby steady workers may have the option of having additional benefits rather than extra increase in wages, and different for seasonal workers. That would be more in the neighborhood of job classifications, and that's something I think that's commonly done all the time. But I think, as Cipriano mentioned earlier, we find that many steady workers have their grievances and could have those grievances addressed. One substantial grievance that exists for steady workers is unjust termination. You could have a guy working on a ranch for 10 years, and tomorrow the grower may go out and say, I don't want you working here anymore. You know, unjust termination. That affects him much more devastatingly than it may for a worker who's been on the job for a week. It may be no less an injustice, but it may be perceived differently. So union representation could be useful for
right,
that worker
but
and for the...
I can see why the steady worker, permanent worker, could very well decide to have union representation. But I can also see that the reasons which would impel the seasonal workers to do so might not apply to the steady worker. And that, I guess I'm wondering if the two shouldn't be able to decide independent of each other whether or not
Let me interject that we should flag this issue. It's really the definition of the bargaining unit. Mm-hmm. Who should be included in a particular bargaining unit, who should be excluded and either not be in it at all or be in a different one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a real good question and a legitimate question we should explore. Can we
move on?
We've described the issue and we should explore it more, and Annette is making a note
okay.
of that particular issue, so we won't leave it behind.
Fine.
And as we continue to uncover issues, we'll flag them and put them on our list.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
As a footnote to that, if I may, Senator Shoemaker, one of the special accommodations in the process that we are proposing in this bill would create what's called a wall-to-wall bargaining unit. And I think that maybe there's further scrutiny with the comment you've made. But the reasoning behind that was to maximize, and I'll mention this later, maximize the simplicity of the elections, because elections are required in a prompt fashion in order not to have to get into issues of who's in which side, who's in which bargaining unit, and so on. Now, that's a balancing test again, and I think we may have to come back to that. But if I may then proceed with walking through the...
Thanks. Sorry for the digression.
No problem.
No, that was an excellent discussion. I'm not intending to discourage the committee from raising these questions, but we need to...
Support of Senate Bill 553. By so doing, I participate in a church social teaching tradition going back to 1891 and Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, which is looked upon as the beginning of the modern era of church social teaching. And within that encyclical, Pope Leo XIII spoke of the right of workers to organize. And most recently, in 1986, the U.S. Catholic bishops, in their pastoral letter on the economy, specifically showed their compassionate concern both for farmers facing the loss of their lands and farm workers and their rights to organize. And I'd specifically like to read a couple of sentences from the economic pastoral, which speaks to the right of farm workers. Speaking about farm workers, the pastoral says, "Moreover, they are not as well protected by law and public policy as other groups of workers, and their efforts to organize and bargain collectively have been systematically and vehemently resisted, usually by farmers themselves. Migratory field workers are particularly susceptible to exploitation. This is reflected not only in their characteristically low wages, but also in the low standards of housing, health care, and education made available to these workers and their families." And in their policy recommendations, the bishops say, "Farmers also must end their opposition to farm worker unionization efforts. Farm workers have a legitimate right to belong to unions of their choice and to bargain collectively for just wages and working conditions. In pursuing that right, they are protecting the value of labor in agriculture, a protection that also applies to farmers who devote their own labor to their farm operations." Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the world is changing, and a reference to a law that I have not heard in this hearing so far is to the Immigration Reform and Control Act, recently enacted in the last couple of years by Congress. The people who are the seasonal agricultural workers will have a right after a number of years to become U.S. citizens. To the extent that they are allowed to avail themselves of the protection of our laws to enable themselves to have decent working conditions and decent wages, they potentially enable themselves and their families to have healthy, happy, economically productive lives that they will then share as U.S. citizens. So I think we serve ourselves by enabling these workers to have just wages and humane working conditions, and those are able to be achieved through collective bargaining. I think the measures which the Senate passed yesterday enabled a ray of sunshine to come through on the horizon. We'd like to see that sun come to full flower and rise high in the sky so that farm workers may share the benefits of their labor in full sunshine.
Questions of the witnesses? If not, thank you very much. Let's see. We have Mr. Michael Dale and Manuel Iturriaga. Is that correct?
Thank you. Senator Kearns, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm with the Farm Worker Program of Oregon Legal Services. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 553, and I'd like to talk about a number of grounds for that. It's already been well covered, I think, that farm workers have some of the same needs in the workplace and have the same desires to better themselves and ought to enjoy the same rights to act collectively as other workers in our society do. And we support the bill on those grounds. I won't belabor that point. We also support the bill because it would have some beneficial effects, we believe, outside of the context of the struggle over collective bargaining or over unionization. And I'd like to focus more specifically on that because I think that that may be a unique perspective that we could offer. While in some parts of the state there are efforts underway to organize workers, in most of the state, farm workers are not being organized. There aren't active efforts underway to organize them. And because of their situation, both in terms of desperate need, in terms of the need to survive from job to job, short-term length of employment, dependency upon a system of labor contractors, and the prevalence of blacklisting or fear of blacklisting, I think in most parts of the state it would be a long time if this legislation were enacted tomorrow before there would be very much labor activity. Nonetheless, we have seen over the years a fair number of circumstances where workers banded together in a non-union context, but in a collective effort to further their wages or working conditions. Maybe it was by passing a petition around. We had a case like that where the people were then fired who were gathering a petition. It may have been, we had one situation out of the Boardman area where a fellow allowed a group of workers that were trying to improve wages at the farm they were working at meet at his house. He was actually, the idea was to get everybody paid the same wage. He was a higher paid worker and he didn't even have a whole lot of stake in it himself, but because they met at his house, he was discharged from employment. We've had circumstances in which people spontaneously in a field when they're not making minimum wage raise issues about compliance with minimum wage, and then they're fired from employment because of that and replaced with other workers. It ought not to be the case that workers who simply talk to others, who simply seek collectively with others to try to better their lot, should pay for that simple act with their jobs. Now, sometimes we can squeeze these retaliatory discharge situations into other statutes or under other potential remedies, but there's a gap in the law, and the gap in the law is one which this bill would remedy. The unfair labor practice language of the underlying act is taken directly from the National Labor Relations Act. Under the National Labor Relations Act, the case law is that workers need not be involved in a union or unionization. They need only be acting collectively in order to be protected, and then the remedies of a complaint to the NLRB are available to them. I would take it, because the language was the same, that our state statute would be interpreted the same way, and that such a remedy would be available, a prompt remedy with an administrative agency with enforcement powers that wouldn't depend upon establishing a new theory of unlawful discharge in the Court of Appeals of the Supreme Court with the worker unemployed and in serious poverty in the meantime while that litigation is going on. I think that that would also be to the benefit of employers to have clear ground rules where what's permitted or forbidden is very clearly laid out in the law, and they don't fall to the vicissitudes of believing that something is okay, and then because we come up with a good theory about why it's a retaliatory unlawful discharge and create some court-made law, that they're then held liable for real substantial costs. We'd rather have a clear playing field. As I mentioned, we have a number of these situations that have arisen about the state. I'd like to introduce to the committee Manuel Iturriaga. Mr. Iturriaga is a worker who has experienced this sort of discharge firsthand, and he would like to tell the committee directly about his experience. Robert Mendoza will be translating for Mr. Iturriaga, who doesn't speak very much English.
My name is Manuel Iturriaga.
I live in Cornelius.
I live in Cornelius.
And I just do it.
What happened with me?
I was
working with Oregon Garden Products.
Excuse me, let me interrupt right there. Is that a name of a firm, or is that a generic term? What are we talking about?
It's the name of the company.
Okay, thank you.
I was working with the company from
87 to 88.
And during all that year, I was supporting everything that they did with us.
And
every Thursday, we had a meeting where they would explain all the things about the work.
And
all this happened on a Thursday.
Cuando tuvimos una junta.
When we had a meeting.
Ocho trabajadores comenzaron a hablar.
Eight workers started talking.
Y no estaban descontentos por el dinero que les estaban pagando.
And they were discontent with the money they were being paid.
Por las cosas que estaban pasando.
And for the things that were happening.
Porque todos tenían, uno tenía que estar comprando todas sus cosas en el trabajo.
Because some of them had to buy all their equipment to for the work.
Y las cosas que lo que nos pagaban no era suficiente para poder comprar uno todas las cosas.
And the pay that they paid us was not sufficient for us to buy the equipment we needed.
Y luego entonces todos cuando comenzaron a hablar.
And then when everyone started talking.
Y luego comencé yo a hablar con ellos.
And I started talking with them.
Y luego llegó este Vicente, el supervisor.
And then Vincent, the supervisor, came by.
Y cuando comencé yo a hablar me dijo que yo estaba corrido.
And when I started talking, he told me that I was fired.
Y entonces todos los demás comenzaron a gritar.
And then all the other workers started yelling.
Que si me corrían a mí iban a correr a todos.
That if they ran me off, they were going to run everybody else off.
Y entonces pues Vicente comprendió lo que estaba haciendo.
And then Vicente understood what he was doing.
Y me dijo a mí que pasara a la oficina para hablar conmigo.
And he told me to go into the office so he could talk with me.
Cuando estábamos en la oficina y me comenzó a decir que
when we were in the office, he started telling me
que ya que parar la gente, que ya no estaba corrido.
That to talk to the people and to stop them, and that I was no longer fired.
Pues entonces yo regresé para atrás con los trabajadores y les dije lo que estaba pasando.
And I returned to the workers and I told them what was happening.
Y entonces todos ellos me dijeron que querían hablar con el patrón.
And then all of them told me that they all wanted to talk with the main boss.
Y entonces llegó el patrón.
And then the boss came.
Y entonces eligieron a otras dos personas.
And they elected two other persons.
Y luego me eligieron a mí.
And they also elected me.
Y comenzamos a hablar con el patrón.
And we started talking with the
la
boss
misma historia.
About the same story.
Y entonces él dijo que él no nos podía ayudar con nada.
And then he told us that he couldn't help us with anything.
Y fue todo lo que nos dijo.
And that was all he basically told us.
Entonces después al siguiente día regresamos a trabajar como de costumbre.
And then the following day we went back to work as was our custom.
Y no pasó nada.
And nothing happened.
Entonces después para el lunes regresamos otra vez a trabajar igual.
And then on Monday we went back to work the same.
Y para el lunes en la tarde me dijo a mí que yo estaba corrido porque andaba alborotando la gente.
And on Monday afternoon I was run off because I was inciting the people. And that was basically all.
I might add to that story that...
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry. Senator Howe.
That's what you were told? You were run off because you were inside?
Yes, es lo que te dijeron y te corrieron?
Me dijeron que...
Yes. They told me that.
Where the Oregon Garden Product Company...
La compañía de Oregon Company. ¿Dónde está localizada?
En Hillsboro.
In Hillsboro.
You have his name now?
¿Tienes el nombre?
Thank you.
If I might add a point or two to Mr. Iturriaga's account, in the personnel file of Mr. Iturriaga with the Oregon Garden Products Company, which was a nursery in Hillsborough, mm-hmm. in his personnel file, there was a rating. He was rated as they had poor, fair, I think unacceptable, poor, fair, good, and excellent as choices. He had four goods and one excellent. And the comment was in his personnel record on termination that he was a fine worker, very intelligent, and a good worker, except for the events of last week. And the entry was made on the Monday following the events that he's described.
Was this a legal case that you pursued?
Yes, we represented Mr. Iturriaga in a case essentially alleging wrongful discharge because the cause of action is not clearly established under Oregon law. In the circuit court in Washington County, the case was dismissed on a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. Appeal was taken to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Along the way, settlement discussions resulted in a dismissal of the appeal and compensation of Mr. Iturriaga. However, I should add that that was compensation taking into account the contingency of his claim and the fact that a clear remedy was not, I think there are excellent grounds for arguing it, but it wasn't clearly established by the law, and there's some contingency about what the Court of Appeals would do with his case and whether the Supreme Court would accept review and what would happen then. So the settlement took that into account, and it happened many, many months after the events, and in the meantime, Mr. Iturriaga was out of his job.
Further questions of these witnesses?
You know, one last question.
Senator Hill?
Michael, if Mr. Iturriaga had been covered by the State Labor Relations Act, that could have been pursued as an unfair employment practice, or unfair labor practice, excuse me.
Yes, it's my understanding that it would be an unfair labor practice that could be handled through this.
And that's the advantage in his particular case that would be gained by the kind of coverage proposed here.
A clear, quick remedy, yes.
Further questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Where are we now? We have Mr. Bob Carpenter. Mr. Carpenter with us. Why don't you come on up? Go right ahead.
Chairman Kearns and members of the Labor Committee, I'm Bob Carpenter from over in Harney County, Oregon, which is a snowy mountain pass and a long ways away today. I didn't hear about this hearing until yesterday. So it was a little hard for me to get really some of the basics involved in this. But first of all, for some background information.
Mr. Carpenter, can you draw the microphone closer to you?
Okay. Is that any better?
That's yeah, perfect. That
thank you. For some background, I'm in agriculture. I've been in agriculture all my life. I was born on a dairy farm, and I have pulled a great many gallons of milk out of cows before I entered high school. After high school, I went into service. But I continued my education after the service in Cal Poly. Been closely associated with those people employed at that time by Sunkist Growers, both in marketing and propagation of agriculture. At the present time, I'm in the beef business. We raise cattle in eastern Oregon. Frankly, at this point, I don't have any problem with migrant workers because I don't personally employ them. I want that understood now. But I do have neighbors very close to us that are involved in sugar beets, corn, onions, and many truck crops, particularly to the east of us where we call it Treasure Valley down there. One of the things I want to draw out here that hasn't been hasn't been spoken of in the past, and that is there's been a great deal of controversy over unionization of agriculture, and there's some very good reasons why this has been excluded from federal legislation. And I hope you will excuse me. Sometimes we speak rather frankly over in that country, and I am no lawyer, and I hope you'll take that under consideration. But perhaps one of the reasons that the thing has been excluded from federal legislation is so that the country doesn't go hungry. I've heard a great deal here at this hearing already about the ideal situation where people could get together and they could bargain and they could choose to have themselves represented by unions. But from a practical standpoint, in practical experience, throughout my life, I haven't seen this happen. I have seen the unionization of people not from within, but from without. I have seen them agitated, I have seen them harangued, and I have seen the employers pitted against their own state governments and the federal governments. And we end up with a situation in agriculture that you don't have in other industries. In agriculture, we cannot set a generator, a starter, a motor block, and a transmission and a differential on a shelf and wait for a union dispute to be settled. In agriculture, the ideal time to strike and create a difficulty for an employer that you want to muscle into an agreement is when the onions are lying on the ground and in 2 to 3 weeks they're rotten. We have no stability in agriculture. Agriculture here is unique in the sense that agriculture doesn't have any stable basis to operate from. We have no guarantees. We're the only industry in the United States, as the saying goes, that buys everything retail and largely sells it, or buys it resale and sells it wholesale. We don't control the price of what we produce. We're at the mercy of the buyer to set a price. Our profit structure is as fickle as the weather or world politics. We never know when we plant a crop or raise calves what they're going to bring, whether the hay that we feed those calves is going to be $40 a ton or $125 a ton, whether the rain will fall so that we can raise the crop or whether it dries up like it did with the beet crop in the Ontario area last year, where many of those people didn't even bother to dig them. They still had to hire migrant workers. Now, a lot of these migrant workers are foreign nationals that come in under the INS regulations and so forth. I'm for everybody in this world being able to wash at a sink and to have a toilet. But I've also noticed that while they guarantee the migrant workers and all these other peoples, and I'm in favor of this, having a toilet, nobody ever thought to guarantee that the employer could afford to buy one for himself. Agriculture has been around a long time, and there's many reasons why we cannot stand to be caught in a pinchers. We cannot stand to be caught with the government at the top dictating employment practices, penalizing us, and at the same time being caught from the bottom, where we end up being picked off, one grower, one rancher, one farmer at a time, by unions that are agitated, controlled, where the votes are taken according to the dictates of large union organizations with almost unlimited funds to fight us with. As individual farmers, we may need maybe 10, maybe 5, maybe 15, but we cannot stand to bring our operation to a standstill for a month while they bring an action, consider negotiations, whatever they want to call it. We can't stand that. It would put us out of business. You can lose a year if this were to occur. It isn't like you're unionizing an industry like the automotive industry or the textile industry, where you have factories that run annually and where you can build into the price of your product The costs of raising the product, the costs of producing it, of advertising it, of marketing, of merchandising, and the sum total of that all ends up a price that you can expect to get from the market, and the market goes up or down and the public pays it. But in agriculture, we have no control over this. I saw this happen in California. I lived in California when you could buy a good American grapes for a nickel a pound. Then we had Mr. Chavez's agricultural revolution down there. The average price of grapes has grown in the United States to the consumer for over 50% a year since that time. Today, right now, you can buy grapes. You'll probably buy them imported in the United States from Chile and other fruits that come in from foreign countries, primarily South America at this time. The fruit that you're buying at the store today may cost you a dollar a pound, and that's more than a worker gets down there for working a whole day. That's what we're competing with. But we have no control over it. It isn't a situation we want to have anything to do with or that we would condone. It isn't that we can't do anything about what those people down there are getting. I have enjoyed traveling into Mexico. The last time I was down there, the workers were getting about $1.80 a day, and the foreman was getting $2.30 a day. And those people wanted to come into the United States, not because the employers in this country were abusing, mistreating, and beating their employees, but because they could make enough money in this country to send it back home so that they could support their people in Mexico, where they couldn't afford to eat otherwise. And there is a clamor, and they're willing to take their lives in their hands and climb the river and escape the helicopters and everything else to get into this country so that they can work for us. We have protection of the minimum wage laws in the United States. These people are not being starved by the policy of our farmers. But I can tell you this, that a person is a lot better off to have no investment in something and no debts and not make any money at it and be a worker than a rancher that might have $1 million capital investment in the ranch and expenses of $100,000 to $200,000 in a year and end up losing $50,000 in a year. But that guy doesn't have any more chance to operate his business if he's making a profit or if he isn't making a profit. Nothing's taken into consideration. In agriculture, we're not organized. We have a few agricultural organizations, such as Farm Bureau and American Cattlemen's Association and so forth. But the farmer is traditionally an individualist. And he's one of the last real down-home grassroots individualists that there exists in this country. And I don't think that we should penalize him by putting him in the pinchers of forcing him to comply with labor requirements, forcing him to organize in order to harvest strawberries for 2 weeks or pick up his onions for 2 or 3 weeks or haul his sugar beets. Ladies and gentlemen, we're the breadbasket of the world. We've been accused in the past of producing too much food for the world. We also provide a lot of jobs for people, and we've been the melting pot for the races of the world to come in here. And many of these form the migrant employee numbers. It bothers me some to have us compared today in this industry with people that beat, butchered, and murdered people back 50 to 80 years ago. I thought that testimony, maybe that did happen 50 to 80 years ago, but we've had a couple of murderous world wars and a police action equally as murderous since that time. They don't apply today. And I think that Senate Bill 553, it is touted as being aimed at limiting unfair labor practices by employers, but I think that aim is a good word because it declares war on the agricultural employer. It doesn't make any requirements of the hunters, who are the unions. I know those unions have a lot more money than I have. If I have to come up against this AFL-CIO in a labor negotiation, have them back the people that are standing around out there on my ranch and won't work while something rots, I know who's going to win. And you can see how apprehensive we are about this. I think 553 is a lousy bill. I think if they want to pass 553 and make it illegal for an employer to terminate an employee in any specific time, I think that then that employee should not be allowed to quit in any specific time. Why not make the same requirements of both sides? Why are we zeroing in on the employers here? Let's make some requirements of the unions. This 553 makes no requirements of unions. All it does is say the employers are indulging in unfair labor practices, and let's do something about it. It doesn't mention secondary boycotts, the scope of contract requirements, what constitutes a union, or any of these other considerations that should be built into good labor legislation. I disagree with it heartily, and I feel kind of alone. I'm the first one here that spoke against this bill. But on the other hand, I want you, this is how I feel. I am a member of Harney County Farm Bureau, and I know what it would do to our people. And I want to remind everyone here that if we don't raise the food to feed the world, gentlemen, who is going to do it? And I just ask you, don't put us out of business by putting us in this vice. And I hope you reconsider on this 553 and do not favorably consider. And I would be glad to answer any questions.
Questions of the witness?
Mr. Chairman, just I appreciate the witness's testimony, especially after the long drive. But I'm not sure you understand exactly what the bill does. For instance, the law that it would subject these processes to provides for unfair labor practices against unions, too. It's just that that part isn't included in the bill. It's included in the law. It already exists, and the unions would be subject to it. And one other point I wanted to raise is, what do you do now if someone strikes against someone in your neighborhood who's raising sugar beets?
What do I do?
What would they do? You see, a strike...
I'm not aware.
A strike right now is perfectly legal.
I'm not aware of any strikes at this particular moment. I think that the
the
amplitude of this...
Your alarm is what I'm addressing. Mm-hmm. If a strike occurred, which is perfectly legal in Oregon right now, without this bill, what would a person in your situation do?
I think we'd have a lot more chance, Senator Hill, of handling it right now than we would with the CIOFL backing up the people out there in funding the action against us. I'm aware of what you're saying, but there's I'm speaking from the standpoint of realism.
Just one last second.
Senator Hill, the witness has traveled a long way. Let's let him complete his sentences, and then we'll ask the next question.
Okay. Let me make one more observation from the chair. There's nothing to prevent right now the AFL-CIO from putting resources into that strike right now without this bill.
From a reality standpoint, respectfully, Senator Hill, I submit that they're still not going to. They put their eggs in the basket where they tend to get the greatest returns on them. The AFL-CIO, I don't personally believe, is going to put any money into any strike where they don't have a union organization.